Right to Ukraine, where a team of international experts has reached the wreckage of Malaysia Air Flight 17 for the first time in a week, an emotional visit. Michael Bocherkiu is a Canadian who's a spokesperson for the Organization for Security and Cooperation in Europe's special monitoring mission to Ukraine. And Michael, where are you right now?
Okay, so we're at the main crash site of MH17. Now, for us, the special monitoring mission, this is our first time back here in almost a week. It took us several hours to get here because we did go from rebel-held territory into the Ukrainian-controlled territory and then back into rebel-held territory. We got here quite smoothly, and we intend to spend quite a few hours here taking the experts around. And, I got to tell you, it's almost 2 weeks since that plane came down, so a group of us just stood there and took a moment of silence and remembrance of the victims.
It must be. Can you describe it? What is it like?
Well, you know, in some ways it's remarkable in the sense that 2 weeks into this, there are many parts that haven't been touched. I know there have been reports and so on of tampering, but everything is more or less the way we saw it a week ago. We still have quite a few more locations to see, especially the cockpit area, but it is pretty much the way we left it, at least for that main section.
And I'm sure that brings a sense of death. You know, it's frozen in amber there. It's a death scene.
Yeah, it is, and a crime scene, too. It's hard to talk about, but yes, the stench of death is still there. It's very hot today. I know from talking to the experts, and they just really did a preliminary kind of sweep through one of the main sections, that these are trained eyes. They've already spotted some human remains. So there's a lot of intensive work to be done by a much larger group of people, and providing the access stays the same tomorrow, that's what's going to start happening tomorrow, finally.
Tell us more about that mission. I mean, what are inspectors looking for and at?
Of course, the priority right now is the kind of forensics, the retrieval of human remains and of personal belongings. There are areas which haven't been touched whatsoever. You can tell by the way the grass or the high grass hasn't been trampled down. So we know that those areas haven't been searched. But they have the expertise to not only spot it, but to retrieve it and care for it with dignity the way it's supposed to be. And then, of course, yeah, the parts of the fuselage. We have senior law enforcement here from both countries, and they're very keen to, for example, look at the parts of the fuselage that perhaps have some telltale marks of anything unusual.
Are there personal possessions still on the ground?
You know, that's the remarkable thing. I just took maybe 3 or 4 minutes myself just to take a quiet stroll along up the edge of one of the impact areas, and it's astonishing. I mean, I saw everything from a travel booklet on Bali to children's toys, Prada shoes. There's a bag of pens from a company that probably someone was taking to a trade show.
Right. What about rebels in the area? They are still in control of the area. Are they there with you?
They certainly are, and they're with us, and they're escorting us. One feels a palpable sense of tension. There was a temporary ceasefire that was negotiated. And as soon as we got to the site, far, far off in the distance, I mean, we're several dozen kilometers at least, there were quite loud explosions. It sounded like mortar fire. So that, of course, is not a good sign, and that's not what's supposed to be happening.
But these rebels that are accompanying you, Do you talk to them at all? Do they have any sense of this, you know, widespread perception that one of them did this?
Yeah, well, they're very different from the chaps that usually escorted us around. They have given us a fair bit of freedom of access. And in the past few days, they kept quite a respectful difference so that experts could do their work. But today, yeah, they were a bit on edge. And in fact, when we first arrived there and the doors opened, it was right at a site where there were a lot of personal belongings. And one of the first things they said, well, see, nobody's touched anything. It's all here for you.
No, defensive, perhaps. Well, we understand Russia says it's going to send its own aviation investigators. Have you seen them yet? And what kind of tension do you expect there?
Well, we don't don't want to speculate. I mean, there's no one else here. That's clear.
Yeah.
The experts weren't interrupted as they were, you know, combing the fields. I think, if I can put it this way, I think everyone acknowledges that the time here on the ground could be limited, that time is of the essence because it is a fluid security situation, so that they will really, really compact their work into as small amount of time as possible.
Michael, one last question. We're seeing pictures from the area as people have finally reached it. What a contrast, it seems. Can you describe that for us? I saw sunflowers and then what you're seeing.
Well, you know, we were put in, I call it an unusual, extraordinary position. We became the initial kind of eyes and ears of the world. And day after day, we would come here and we'd become almost intimately familiar with pieces of the airplane, with personal belongings. For me, one of the belongings that I'll never forget is someone scribbled a note to themselves, it looks like, on the flight, and they were obviously on their way to vacation, and they said, you know, I'm so looking forward to vacation, and they made a pledge to themselves not to blow their budget, but yet to have a good time. And then, you know, really the toughest part to look at is a very heavily scorched piece of earth where the wings, the fuel tanks came down, and the heat in that particular impact site was so severe that it actually melted the wings of the 17-year-old airplane. And, you know, we arrived here only really less than 24 hours after the plane came down, and there are some things we've seen that we'll never talk about, I'm sure, to anybody. Yeah. It was pretty horrific.
Yeah, all surrounded by sunflowers. Michael Borchyrku, spokesperson for the Organization for Security and Cooperation in Europe's special monitoring mission to Ukraine. He's there at the site of MH17. Michael, thank you.
You're most welcome. Thank you.
Well, now to Colorado, where there is a last-minute push to turn in signatures for ballot questions in November. The deadline is Monday. And a couple of those ballot questions could have an effect on which party controls the U.S. Senate. Joining us to explain is Megan Verlee, reporter for Here and Now, contributor, Colorado Public Radio. Megan, welcome.
Hi, Jeremy.
So these ballot questions that some Democrats are worried about are backed by Democratic Congressman Jared Polis from Colorado. Tell us what they would do.
Well, the first would create a 2,000-foot setback between drilling operations and any occupied structure, so a house, a school, a business. That's a lot larger than the state has right now. Currently, the setback limit is around 500 feet, so this is a massive increase. And then the other one, the other initiative, would create an environmental bill of rights, which would allow local governments to set stricter environmental regulations than the state does, really shifting the balance of power and regulation to local governments. And it's unclear exactly how that might be used, but, you know, there's some thought that local governments that are concerned about drilling could try and turn to that to ban energy development entirely.
And we see that Coloradans for Safe and Clean Energy says it's gotten more than 98,000 signatures on that setback initiative and more than 96,000 to add to the Environmental Bill of Rights. Is that enough? Are these on the ballot yet?
They are not on the ballot yet, but they're well over the number they need and within the margin where even if some of those signatures get thrown out, they're very likely to be on the ballot.
So why are Democrats so nervous about this on a national level?
Well, you've got to look at the election situation overall in Colorado. We have a U.S. Senator, Mark Udall, who's in a very tight race against a Republican Congressman, Cory Gardner. And then we also have a governor who's in a very tight race. Both of them are concerned that these initiatives could bring out a lot of Republican voters who are worried that if they pass, they're going to drive industry out of the state. They're going to make Colorado less, especially oil and gas friendly, but less business friendly in general. So there's a concern that it could drive up Republican turnout in what's already likely to be a good Republican turnout year. And then there's some concern that they might depress Democratic turnout for those two races because both Udall and Hickenlooper, our governor, are opposing these ballot initiatives. They say they're bad for the state. They're urging voters to vote against them. And so if you've got Democratic voters who are angry about oil and gas development near their homes, are worried about these issues, and they hear a lot that Democratic candidates aren't supporting them, they might just sit those two top races out entirely and hand the Senate race to Cory Gardner. And that's one more seat that the Republicans have picked up towards their goal of taking back the U.S. Senate.
And by the way, on the point of the people who oppose this measure or one of these measures, the Stan Dempsey, who's head of the Colorado Petroleum Association, says that it would cut in half the amount of land available for fracking in Colorado if it passes. Is that true?
I think you have to take any statements like that from either side with a grain of salt, but it would significantly limit the easily available area for these companies. Because if you think about 2,000 feet, that's almost a half a mile. And we've got where the drilling is happening right now, it's densely populated enough that once you're a half a mile away from one house, you're probably within a half mile of another. The initiatives would allow companies to work out deals with homeowners to be closer to their structures, but it would definitely make drilling a lot more complicated than it is right now.
So you've got the Democratic senator and the Democratic governor saying they're not in favor, and you've got Jared Polis saying, I'm going forward with it. What's he saying?
Well, Polis has been, in direct conversations, rather coy about his support for these initiatives. When I talked with him, he wouldn't even really say outright that he was going to vote for them. But it's understood that he is putting his own money behind them. He has a significant personal fortune. And Polis represents a very blue part of the state, a part of the state that's seeing a lot of drilling and where residents are very upset about it. And he also has a history of being his own man, in part because he can be self-funded in his political campaigns. And so he has so far not backed down in the face of what seems to be a tremendous amount of pressure from his own party not to make this an issue this year.
And what are the predictions right now?
Right now, the industry seems to have polling that suggests they can beat these initiatives. But in the past, voters have, at least in blue parts of Colorado, have seemed in favor of passing more restrictions on the industry. So it's really anybody's guess.
Megan Verlee, reporter with Here Now contributor Colorado Public Radio. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Earlier this week, we spoke with Silicon Valley entrepreneur Tim Draper about his ballot drive to break California up into six states. Draper told us he grew up in California, but he thinks it's declined since then.
K-12 schools have gone from first in the nation to 47th in the nation. As a place to do business, we've gone from the best place to do business to literally the worst, 50th out of 50. And we have the most people below the poverty line. Almost 20% of the people in California live below the poverty line. Government has gone very much downhill. We're not getting the best service for our money.
So Draper wants to split the state into six states, and he says he has the signatures to put the issue on the ballot in 2016. Opponents of the idea have organized a group called One California. It's led by Joe Redotta, who advised California Republican governors Arnold Schwarzenegger and Pete Wilson, and Steve Maviglio, who was the press secretary for former California Democratic Governor Gray Davis. Steve Maviglio joins us now from Capital Public Radio in Sacramento. Steve, welcome.
Thank you.
Well, why do you say California should stay as one California and not six, as Tim Draper wants to happen?
Well, you know, Mr. Draper is a very smart man, and he's right. The state has a lot of challenges. But unfortunately, there is no nexus whatsoever between his idea to break up the state and solving some of those challenges.
Well, he says that one of the things that having six Californias would do is it would make the people feel a little closer to their governments because there would be six state governments instead of just one.
Well, I served in the New Hampshire legislature myself for 6 years, and I can tell you the same complaints that he has about California state government can be heard in a state where there's 400 members of the state house there. If you have problems with government, the size of it is not going to make a difference. He cited that California was rated the worst managed state. The fourth worst rated state is Rhode Island, the smallest of all our states. So again, there's just no connection between this idea and actually solving the state's challenges.
So why do you think then that more than a million people have signed on to this idea?
Well, I think it just proves what's wrong with the initiative system in California, that somebody with an unlimited checkbook can get you to sign about anything. Here in California, people stand in front of the targets and get paid by their signatures. In this particular case, he set the record, almost $3 per signature. And as you noted the other day, there were many cases of election fraud, people with petitions over the other one to raise or not raise the gas tax, for example, to lure people to sign this. So at the end of the day, I think a lot of people were hoodwinked, and we filed a complaint with the Secretary of State to investigate that.
Well, do you think that California is managed well right now in its current state?
Well, you know, I was listening to Mr. Draper talk about how 40 years ago, how great the state was. And the last time I checked, we're pretty much the same size, adding a few more million people. So it's not a function of the size. We fortunately have a governor who is actually addressing some of the concerns he's talking about. So he sees the glass half empty. I see it half full. And finally, we have some politicians here in Sacramento that are turning the state around.
So you don't see any decline going on?
Well, certainly. There are challenges the state faces, whether it's education or many other things, pensions. We've got problems, and so does every other state in the union. This, unfortunately, doesn't address any of those things. It's just an idea by someone who has a lot of money to put on the ballot.
What about the idea that California, which has a huge population, only has the same two senators that any other state has, just like Rhode Island or Wyoming? It's just got two U.S. senators, that its influence in Washington is smaller than it should be based on the size of the state, that maybe splitting up into six would give Californians more of a voice in the Capitol.
Well, I think that was a vexing problem in 1776 with the senators from New York and the senators from Delaware to be. Many states feel like they didn't get equal representation as they should. The practical reality is that the United States Senate and the House of Representatives would both have to approve this if it were passed, and that's not going to happen. There's no interest whatsoever in Washington, D.C. for adding 10 more United States senators. I mean, look how long it's taken Washington to try to get one House seat.
But do you think that it's fair that California only has two senators?
I think that's the way our system is set up, and we have the largest delegation, which would now be cut up into six. So therefore, the people who now live in the state would have their clout even reduced more. And we also have the majority leader in the House right now, and Nancy Pelosi. We have Senator Feinstein and Boxer who have a lot of seniority. We have a lot of clout right now, and this would diminish that automatically.
What about the other argument that Tim Draper was making about that, about the job of being a senator for California, which is – it's very hard to represent all those views.
Yeah, that's absolutely true. But I think in many ways our state is better for that. When you have the kind of force that those senators have because of the size of our state, because our delegation is so big, that makes waves in Washington when they stick together.
So where do you see this going? Just nowhere?
Well, you know, if there was a tax on political stupidity, this probably would balance the national debt. I mean, it's going nowhere. It's going to lose at the polls. It's not ever going to pass Congress. But what it's doing, though, is actually damaging the California brand. When you hear Tim Draper talk about his measure, he starts off with a five-minute riff about how bad California is. That doesn't create jobs. That doesn't get people to move here. That doesn't increase economic activity. It tears the state down. And then there's the other practical things that will never happen, like imagine coming up with new six state birds and state flowers and all those crazy things. And so how this somehow could create less bureaucracy rather than more, I can't fathom that, because having 600 more politicians and lieutenant governors and different levels of counties and all kinds of crazy stuff, it's going to be a massive bureaucracy and a $1 trillion cost to it. You know, one of the things he doesn't like to talk about is the income inequity this would cause in our state. We have, as you heard on your program recently from a farmer, a very poor part of our state, the Central Valley. They need water from the rest of the state. What if the northern part of the state decided to shut them off? They'd fall further back in poverty levels and so forth. Same way, vice versa. What if the Central Valley decided it wanted to export its food not to some of the other states, but to other states in other directions? We'd be in trouble. So we're mutually dependent here, and I think diversity of the state is really its strength.
Well, and Tim Draper would say that if you were to make Central California its own state, it would boost the economy of the region because the government would be more responsive to the voters.
Well, if you look at education spending, which is the biggest part of the California state budget, the rest of the state actually subsidizes the Central Valley in many ways because they can't raise that kind of money they need to educate their children there. If you erase that and you make the people in the Central Valley pay, quote, full price for their price of education, I don't think that would move that region up the needle economically at all. Plus, you have the issue of our university system. Suddenly, many parts of the state would have to be paying out-of-state tuition for their kids. In Jefferson, they have no UC campus. Suddenly, all those families that are getting the state rate would be paying $36,000 a year tuition. I don't think they'll be too happy about that.
If you're so sure that this isn't going to go anywhere, then why did you decide to get involved and form One California?
Well, you know, for many months, people just laughed this off and said it's silly. But you know what? Now it's going to be on the ballot. Now it's actually damaging our state's credibility. So we have formed a group to oppose it because we want to raise the questions about this and what it really means. You know, how it's going to impact everything from our state parks to our energy system, our water system, things where the state is together and has state plans, our pension system. We want to raise questions about the cost and the actual practicality of it. You know, it's nice to try to blow up the state, but you should really have a plan once you do that, what's going to happen with the rest of them.
Steve Maviglio is co-founder of the group One California. He's also with Forza Communications. Steve, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
And if you want to hear our conversation with Tim Draper, go to hearandnow.org and let us know where you stand on splitting up California.
The preseason controversy around one of the NFL's star players is not going away. Last week, NFL Commissioner Roger Goodell imposed a two-game regular season suspension on Baltimore Ravens running back Ray Rice because of his arrest in February for assaulting his then-fiancée, now-wife, Janae Palmer. There's a cell phone video of Rice dragging her off an elevator at Atlantic City Casino after police say he knocked her out. Today, Ray Rice spoke about it at a Ravens training camp.
It was the first time it ever happened. I've never had a problem with domestic abuse. It never happened. This was a one-time incident.
But after the suspension came the critics, saying it was too lax. Sports Illustrated's Don Banks wrote, NFL not usually tone-deaf, but two-game suspension for Ray Rice defies logic and explanation, sends wrong message. Then the debate took to the airwaves. And, well, let's start with the suspension. Here now is sports analyst and host of the podcast The Gist at Slate.com, Mike Pesca, is here to weigh in. Mike, first of all, your thoughts on Ray Raven's words today?
Yeah, Ray Rice. Ray Rice of the Ravens. This comes on the heels of the original press conference that he gave where his then-fiancée, now-wife, was next to him. And she actually apologized for her role in the incident, which might have been seen as a slip of the tongue, but then the Ravens Twitter account actually repeated that as if it were some notable news. He never apologized to her in that original press conference, which, by the way, took place on a Friday at 3 p.m. before a three-day weekend. So there was a lot of pressure on Ray Rice to say something like, I am apologetic for my actions, and he finally did today. And we heard him being contrite. And, you know, I've interviewed him a couple times over the years, and he certainly seems like, you know, a fine young athlete and has a lot of positive things going for him. And maybe this and what Roger Goodell perceived as actual contrition is why Roger Goodell chose to give perhaps one of the most lenient sentences of his entire tenure as commissioner.
It's the same penalty the NFL imposed on Cleveland Browns receiver Josh Gordon when he tested positive for marijuana.
I mean, guys have been suspended. Terrell Pryor got suspended for NFL games for five games because in college he got some tattoos, some impermissible benefits. And Roger Goodell established himself early on as a hanging judge. He gave harsher punishments than his predecessors had, oftentimes harsher punishments than anyone thought he would give. He suspended the coach of the New Orleans Saints for an entire year for sort of presiding over a situation where, you know, extra hard hits and bounties were given. I mean, that's still kind of up in the air. But Roger Goodell has never, to my mind, has never apologized, not only for his actions. I've been looking at the record. He's actually never apologized for anything, even in instances like when he got into a labor dispute. I say he, the league, got into a labor dispute with the refs, and it's largely seen as a horrible four games that the replacement refs presided over. He's never apologized for that. And if you look at how he reacted to the unbelievable, I mean, from every precinct, the unbelievable uproar over the leniency of this penalty. And I think correctly saying, how can the NFL want women fans and claim it's pro-women and give out such a weak penalty for this? He has actually not said anything. He's not given an interview. He has not commented on it. He, I believe, just thinks this will blow over and people love football.
Well, it's not. And we just have a few seconds, but you mentioned that Ray Rice's wife seemed to imply she was at fault. ESPN's Stephen Smith then urged women not to provoke domestic violence, which caused an uproar. He apologized for that. Just a few seconds here, Mike. Any chance there's a learning moment here using the game to teach lessons about domestic violence?
I think what we learn is what the NFL's priorities are, that they think that they have a product that everyone loves so much that they could not even do what ESPN did and suspend and address these horrible statements. I mean, there seems to be nothing that Goodell will do to take or walk his statements back.
Stephen Smith suspended, but then he apologized. Mike Pesca, Here Now sports analyst, also hosting the podcast The Gist on Slate.com. Mike, thank you.
You're welcome.
and now we're drinking. Not really. We are, though, going to take a look at some summer drinks with our favorite chef, Kathy Gunst. Hi, Kathy.
Hello, both of you.
And
hi.
You usually are here to talk food and recipes, but, you know, when we think of summer drinks, and people do, suddenly you're thinking of lemonade and things that you wouldn't be thinking of in winter.
Well, you know, they always tell you stay hydrated in the summer. And I don't know if you're like me. I just get really busy. I'm either working or gardening, and I forget to drink water. I forget to drink anything. So I thought, this is what we need. We need to take a deep breath, middle of the day, too much bad news going on, and just kind of celebrate summer with some really fun, interesting drinks that have very little sugar. So you mentioned lemonade. That's the classic summer drink. How about a lime Ricky? It's a really old-fashioned drink. So instead of lemon, you use fresh-squeezed lime juice, little seltzer, just a little bit of sugar to cut that strong lime flavor, and a slice of lime and a lot of ice cubes. And all of a sudden, the day's about 10 degrees cooler.
That's right. And what about tea? Because, you know, you could do the iced tea. You know, people are now buying the, you know, gallons of iced tea all sugared up. How can you make that more fun?
Well, first of all, I don't even like sugar in my tea at all. I like making sun tea. I will go to my garden and pick a massive handful of fresh mint leaves. Sometimes I'll throw in some tarragon or lemon balm or lemon verbena. I put it into a big glass pitcher or, you know, just a glass jar, fill it with water, put it out in the hottest part of your yard, your window where the sun hits it, and you have this beautiful tea. It's completely ecological. You could add a little honey. You could add a little sugar syrup or nothing. This mint tea is so refreshing.
You know, I have to say, too, that her garden, Jeremy, you'll get up there, something is just extraordinary.
But you ready to go, Jeremy?
I'm ready.
Although I want to know first,
what is lemon verbena?
Lemon verbena is a fresh herb that is just the essence of lemon. It looks like a member of the mint family. I'm not sure it is, but you
pinch
it off, and it's like you just squeezed 12 lemons.
We have some on the windowsill.
We also have a bunch of drinks here in front
you
of us
do.
To try, Kathy.
Party.
So let's get to that. Yeah.
Not really. They're all non-alcoholic, but we can talk about how we can remedy that. So, okay, start with the cucumber mint water. Okay. Do you see that in front of you?
Yep.
It's got pieces of cucumber and mint. This is like, have you ever been to a spa? Let's be honest here. Have you ever been to a spa?
Yes.
Okay, good. So you know how they have those big gallons of water with cucumbers and mint, and that classic cliche of a spa where you put the cucumber slices on your eyeball? I thought, a bunch of baloney, ridiculous. But then you taste that stuff, and it's really good.
Let me try this.
And it's a great way to mask the flavor of bad city water. So what you do is you peel a cucumber partway or all the way, slice it thin, put it in a pitcher with some cold water and a ton of fresh mint, and an hour later, you have this flavored water. Isn't that
it's
subtle?
So much more refreshing, too.
Yeah.
Do you feel the zen taking you over?
I feel like I'm getting a massage
right now.
There's
a glow.
Look at his
around
skin.
Jeremy.
Look at him.
You know, I want to say, these things are so easy. I was going to mention with the mint, you put an idiot can grow mint. I'm not looking at anyone. An idiot can grow mint because it just...
I feel you were looking at me.
No, because it just takes off.
It's a weed. It's a weed.
Weed.
Yeah. I have it growing down this staircase by my garden, and I cannot control it.
Yeah.
But it's a great thing. Let's talk about fruit syrups, okay? Because this is so simple. You take half a cup of sugar and 2 cups of water. Okay,
half a cup of sugar, 2 cups of water.
Yep, okay. Bring it to a boil and let it cook until it just starts to turn color. Then you can throw in any summer fruit you like. You have about 4 different varieties there.
Okay.
So you guys try them and I'll talk. I brought fresh seltzer from the seltzer machine here. And what you've got is a sugar syrup. In one case, I made a strawberry mint syrup. You see I'm on a mint theme here. You just throw in all these fresh berries with the fresh mint and some ice cubes and seltzer. And it's a homemade soda. It's completely refreshing. And you control how much sugar you add. You only need about a tablespoon of the syrup to the entire glass of seltzer.
Just a spoonful of sugar, if you will.
I feel a song coming on.
Am I making people thirsty?
Also, there is a blueberry ginger soda in front of you.
Okay.
But
that's strawberry.
Yeah, that is.
That's amazing. The
so
mint.
So fresh. Also, let me tell you something. You know those old-fashioned ice cube trays that, like, probably people your age, Jeremy, don't know about, but like that
I
used to be in a freezer.
Excuse me.
You do? Okay. I'm sorry, Robin. You know, you and I.
I'm well versed with ice cube trays.
Make the syrup using fresh raspberries, fresh blackberries. Throw them into the ice cube trays and just pop them out as you need them and throw them into a glass of seltzer. add a little rum, throw in some vodka, a lemon slice. You are really cooling off and celebrating summer properly.
I'm drinking.
All right, you drink. Which one are you drinking?
Blueberry. Have you tried
the blueberry ginger? Tastes sort of like a tea.
Okay, I've got one. Really?
Oh,
huh.
Wow.
Yeah.
Okay, can you see the
it's
one
like
in front
Earl
of
Grey.
You that's called a shrub? A shrub is not the bush in front of your house. A shrub is an old-fashioned acidulated drink. It's got vinegar in it. So it's that blueberry ginger syrup. He doesn't like
this,
it.
No,
you know
don't
what?
Like that
you
one.
Would like it if it had gin in it.
Okay, what does this taste like?
Vinegar.
Vinegar.
It tastes like
yeah,
a salad
okay.
without the salad.
It's what it does.
Maybe you need some olive oil. Can I talk about the shrub anyway?
Yeah, please.
Quickly,
please
old-fashioned 17th and 18th century England, they used to drink these with rum and sugar, but it was a way of preserving fresh fruit. The vinegar would keep it fresh. So
the shrub is what they called it.
Yes, and it's okay. An extremely in vogue thing with hot bars these days. So, Jeremy, I'm not totally
so
crazy
vinegar
here.
And blueberry.
Blueberry and ginger syrup, and
wow.
Then I added some white wine or good cider vinegar. It's also really good for you.
I'm going back to the strawberry mint.
Speaking of bartenders, I was recently at a great place in Portland, Maine called Eventide. It's an oyster bar, and they have an incredible bar. And I was talking to the bartender there, John Myers, and he was telling me about this drink he makes with basil, fresh cucumber, and ginger beer. Mm. Mm. So you muddle. Here's another bartendery word. Muddle is to, it literally means messy and confusing, but in bartender talk, you're crushing fruit or herbs to release the flavor, like they do with mint in a mojito. Mm. So he muddles basil and cucumber and a little bit of lime, and then he adds ice and a simple syrup, and then ginger beer, and then if you want, some rum or London dry gin. I thought that sounded very refreshing.
You know, if you stop before the alcohol, what a great thing for kids to do, like to
completely
occupy them on a rainy
homemade
day.
Homemade soda and not yeah. a lot of sugar.
Terrific.
And not a lot of extra work for their parents if they want to put the alcohol in it.
Well,
later.
All right.
Later.
You're a step
after
ahead.
After the kids have gone to bed.
Or not.
Kathy Gunn's here now, resident chef, and we've got all these recipes at our website, hereandnow.org. Just had to swallow
the vinegar.
A little bit of that. Yeah, the vinegar still tastes still in my mouth. Kathy, thanks as always.
Thanks, guys.
You can pour that one on your salad.
This is a KLRN news bulletin. A sniper with a high-powered rifle has taken up a position on the observation deck of the tower on the campus of the University of Texas. He is firing at persons within his range.
This is a warning to the citizens of Austin. Stay away from the university area. Traffic is now converging on this area. A boy riding a bicycle.
That sound from Monday, August 1st, 1966, 48 years ago tomorrow. A University of Texas student named Charles Whitman lugged a footlocker full of weapons to the top of the clock tower at the University of Texas in Austin and started shooting down at the campus below. By the end of the day, 16 people were dead, more than 30 wounded. It was the first mass shooting on an American campus. Elizabeth Crook uses this event as the foundation for her new novel, Monday, Monday. She joins us from KUT in Austin, Texas. Elizabeth, welcome.
Thank you, Jeremy. You're good to have me.
Well, and you were only 6 or 7 when this happened. Do you remember it?
Actually, most Texans do. I was at my grandmother's funeral on the coast, and we did not have access to a television, and so I wasn't one of those people who was watching it unfold live.
But you describe it so vividly in your novel. Tell us more about what happened on that day.
Well, Charles Whitman, before the day started, actually, he murdered his wife. He murdered his mother. He armed himself with, actually he went and bought some of the guns that morning and the ammunition, and he apparently had been planning to do this for some time. He had spoken with a psychiatrist at the university and expressed frustration and feelings of anger and hostility, and had even said that he had fantasies of doing things like going up in the tower and shooting a lot of people. So anyway, on this day, that's what he did. He went up there and with a high-powered rifle, he was able to take aim at a number of pedestrians below. It was summer school, but there were still a number of people here. And then he just methodically began to kill people.
Well, and I want to have you read a little bit of when that shooting happened in your book. And we're talking about fictional characters here, but Shelley Maddox, Wyatt Calvert, and Jack Stone are there. And it's in the beginning, we're talking about Shelley here. If you could just read from page 7.
She tried to look at the tower, but the sun was too intense. She pawed at the ground, breathing hard and coughing with nausea, but her wounded arm just hung there. She heard herself wail. The hedge was only knee-high and wouldn't protect her, even if she could reach it, yet it was the only vertical shape the world offered. Everything else was flat ground. Things flew about her. There was the thud of impact on flesh and bone. Not hers, she thought. Not me this time. A whimper and cry. The hot concrete seared her palm when she tried to pull herself forward, dragging her mangled arm. Blood seeped into the porous stone beneath her. The frayed bra held her breast to her body and kept the lump of flesh from dropping like jello. She whispered for someone to help her and methodically lifted her palm, then methodically set it down, pulling her knees forward, watching her blood bubble into the ground.
It's hard to listen to. It's hard to read, but it's riveting. You can't put it down. Why was it that you decided to focus on this for your novel?
I saw an article in Texas Monthly by Pamela Koloff, and what she had done, this was on the 40th anniversary of the shooting, and so she had taken together and sort of stitched together firsthand accounts, people who were affected by this day or who lost someone or who knew Whitman. And so the story unfolded in this very organic way, sort of moment by moment, the way she told it. And what was so interesting to me was that she was not focused on Whitman himself and what he did, but on how people responded. This was the first time, of course, that anything like this had happened in our country. And so the reactions were very raw. People did not, I think when we watch the news today, we're able to sort of put ourselves in the place of these people, you know, that witness something like this and think, how would I react? What would I have done in this instance? We can kind of rehearse. We can think, you know, maybe I would be one of the people that rushed to the rescue, or maybe I wouldn't. And none of these people there that day had any way to, you know, think ahead about this. And so they were just reacting very instinctively. And it was fascinating to me how many people acted heroically and very bravely in this instance. I mean, rushing out into the line of fire and dragging people off of the mall where they had been wounded.
Well, and you wrote this, by the way, before Virginia Tech, before Sandy Hook. How did you see those events when they happened after you had started writing this book?
Right. I started the book looking at it as really an historical incident and kind of isolated. And then as those events began to sort of unfold horribly in front of, you know, all of our eyes, I felt suddenly I was writing a very different kind of book, because this was then, you know, a situation that we have in our country rather than something that had happened in the past.
How is this shooting remembered now 40-some years later? You live in Austin now.
I have been surprised since I started writing the book by how many people were deeply affected by this event and are still here in Austin. If I'm visiting with a group of 10 people, I find that there's usually one who was there. And that sort of surprised me. The university, I think, has had a very difficult time, you know, figuring out how to deal with this, because they don't want the tower to be just this gigantic monument to this tragedy. But there is still, if you go up in the tower on a tour, I had a friend who did this recently, and it was pretty extraordinary because he heard someone in the crowd ask the guide about this event, and she replied that they were not allowed to talk about this, that the officer on the guide could talk about this. Well, the officer didn't seem to have a lot of facts about it. And so I think there's still this ambivalence as to how to deal with it. You know, at the University of Texas. In Austin, in general, if you talk to people of a certain age, we all remember it.
It becomes very clear in the very beginning why the book is called Monday, Monday. Shelley hears this song right before the shooting begins. But why did you decide to call the book Monday, Monday?
I think that song sort of resurrects that time. It was one of the most popular songs at the time. A number of people do remember hearing it that day. It was often played on Mondays, and this happened on a Monday. And so the beginning of the book is a Monday, and then when Shelley returns 40 years later and goes up into the tower, it just happens to be another Monday. So the book sort of travels between those two Mondays 40 years apart.
Elizabeth Crook, her new novel is Monday, Monday. Elizabeth, thanks so much for speaking with us.
Jeremy, thank you so much.
Monday, Monday, so good to me. Monday morning, it was all I hoped it would be. Oh, Monday morning, Monday morning, couldn't guarantee that Monday evening you would still be here with me. Monday, Monday, can't trust that day. Monday, Monday, sometimes it just turns out that way. Oh, Monday morning, you gave me no warning of what was to be. Oh, Monday, Monday, how could you leave and not take me?
Just never hear that song the same way again. Mm-hmm. We've got an excerpt of the book, by the way, at our website, hereandnow.org. Here Now is a production of NPR and WBUR Boston in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. This is Here Now.